Kia ora, and welcome to this edition of the Big Q podcast. My name is Sam Smith, and today, Thursday the 28th of October in Aotearoa, New Zealand, is the now annual National Day of Remembrance for the New Zealand Wars, the New Zealand Wars of the 19th century between the Indigenous Māori people and British colonial troops and supporters are one of this country's most significant historical events, if not its most significant, but has taken a long time to be commemorated or indeed acknowledged in terms of a day where people can come together to remember the lives lost, the devastation caused, and reflect on what the wars mean today in the 21st century. Now, joining me today to discuss the New Zealand Wars and their place in modern-day Aotearoa is renowned New Zealand historian Vincent O'Malley. He is a founding partner of History Works, a group of historians specializing in Treaty of Waitangi research. He's also the author of a number of books on New Zealand history, most notably the New Zealand Wars and the Great War for New Zealand, Waikato, 1800 to 2000. Kia ora, Vincent. How are you?
Kia ora, Sam. Good, thank you.
So I guess, starting off, how did you become interested in writing about the New Zealand Wars?
My initial research into this was for the Waitangi Tribunal process, which I've been involved in for nearly 30 years now. And back in about 2006, I was commissioned to write a couple of reports for the Waitangi Tribunal's Rohe Pota Inquiry, otherwise known as the King Country. And at the time I did that, everybody assumed that the story was already widely known. It had been covered. You know, Jamie Balich has written his wonderful book, New Zealand Wars in 1986. But as I got deeper and deeper into that research, I discovered kind of new areas that amazed me. One of them, for example, was I calculated that Māori casualty rates in the invasion of Waikato were probably higher on a per capita basis than those suffered by New Zealand troops during World War I, and that blew me away. And I thought, if I didn't know that, then probably most other people didn't either. So those reports that everybody initially thought would be quite short summaries of existing research turned into be major kind of works of research. One was 900 pages long and the other was 700 pages. And then, I mean, the thing about the treaty claims process is this incredibly rich mine of research is completed through there, but most of it doesn't see the light of day. So claimants and a handful of lawyers and tribunal members see that. But right. To me, this needs to be shared with a wider audience. So after I completed those reports in about 2008, I think, I spent years trying to pull together some funding to write a book drawing in part on that, because this wasn't the sort of book I could write at nights and weekends. I needed, you know, a few years to go through this material. And eventually I got a 12-month fellowship at Victoria University that allowed me to work on this full-time for that period. And that was the support that I needed, really, to get that underway. So became the Great War for New Zealand, 2016, and then 2019, the New Zealand Wars book, which is a shorter overview of all of the conflicts, not just the Waikato War.
Mm-hmm. Now, for those who might not know exactly, what were the New Zealand Wars?
These were a series of conflicts fought between the Crown and various groups of Māori between 1843 and 1872. I mean, the start and end points are debatable in many ways. And they brought about 18,000 British troops to New Zealand, which the Pākehā population in New Zealand in 1858 was about 59,000. So 18,000 troops in the country. We're talking military occupation, really. And right. Professor Charlotte MacDonald has described New Zealand as a garrison colony at this time. So many British soldiers stationed here. And, you know, so these are a series of conflicts rather than a single one, and they happen in Northland and Taranaki and Waikato, of course, in the Bay of Plenty, Hawke's Bay, the East Coast and elsewhere. You know, all of them have kind of discrete factors involved in them, but there are some kind of underlying issues related to all of them. And one of them really is about how are Māori and Pākehā going to live together? And in part that goes back to how did they understand Te Tiriti signed in 1840? On the one hand, Māori had been promised partnership and tino rangatiratanga. They would manage their own affairs as they always had. On the other hand, the Crown kind of had this expectation that they were in charge now, and that accorded with the mindset of a lot of settlers who arrived in New Zealand, because they in their minds, they hadn't traveled 12,000 miles around the world to play second fiddle to a bunch of natives. So that they were at the apex of their own imagined racial hierarchy, really. So there are all of these kind of factors going into it. And obviously their desire for land as well is hugely important. So that's why, I mean, in terms of these two different kind of understandings of what the relationship would be about, partnership or hegemony, that's not resolved in 1840. It's really in the 1860s and the New Zealand Wars that that is decided. And that's why these conflicts have consequences for us today, because in effect, the treaty is thrown out the window for the next century or more after the 1860s, because the Crown achieves enough to impose its version of that as a treaty of cession rather than a treaty of partnership.
Now, there have been some debates around the name of these wars. Some have called them the Land Wars, the Māori Wars, the New Zealand Wars. Do you you favour the name the New Zealand Wars, and why do you think this is the appropriate name?
Well, I think, I mean, it's interesting to trace just the history of how what they've been called has changed over time, and that partly reflects changing understandings of what these conflicts were about. And of course, you know, for a long time they were known as the Māori Wars, at least amongst Pākehā.
Right.
And that reflected the usual British practice of naming wars after the countries or people that they invaded and attacked. So you've got the Zulu War, the Boer War, the Indian Mutiny, and so on. Problem with that, with Māori Wars, is it renders the other combatants invisible. It wasn't just Māori fighting amongst themselves. Later on, from the sort of 1960s, 1970s, a number of people call them the Land Wars, and that in part reflects a more sympathetic approach towards Māori viewpoints and understanding these wars as motivated in part by land hunger by the settlers. Problem with that, as various historians have pointed out over the years, including Jamie Balich, is that land was definitely an important factor in these wars, but it wasn't just about land. It was about so much more. It was about these things that I mentioned about the two different versions or two different expectations about the treaty relationship, about these ingrained kind of racial attitudes that settlers arrived in New Zealand with, their desire to impose the rule of British law over Māori communities and so on. And so, you know, that's so much more than land. And that's why I think the New Zealand Wars is the appropriate term, because these were conflicts of what the nation was and what it would become, really.
How were these wars fought exactly?
Well, military historians would describe them as asymmetrical warfare, because on the one hand, you've got really the world's sole superpower at the time, Great Britain, up against not even the entirety of Māoridom, but, you know, groups from some iwi. And Māori are frequently outnumbered, usually 3-4-1 in these conflicts. The British have heavy artillery. In most of these conflicts, Māori have none. Occasionally, they'll find a rusty ship's cannon somewhere and they'll use that, but nothing compared with, you know, at Gate Pa in 1864, the British used 110-pound Armstrong gun, which is probably the biggest ever fired in New Zealand at any time, I'd imagine. And so there is this, the fact that Māori are outnumbered and have all these other disadvantages kind of dictates the nature of the conflicts, which is that the Crown or the British forces are wanting to draw Māori into open conflict, because then their natural superiority in terms of numbers and technology will prevail at the end of the day, while Māori are attempting to apply more flexible tactics to really to minimise their losses, and to not just in terms of lives lost, but also land that's occupied by the British troops, because in the 1860s, they realised that for every mile that the British troops occupy, that will be another area of land that's confiscated ultimately from them. So it's an attempt to sort of, it's a damage limitation exercise, really, in terms of the tactics that Māori employ, and that's sometimes like disrupting British supply lines, ambushing parties of troops, those sorts of things. So there's a very creative kind of way to engage in this. And of course, as James Balance has referred to, Māori also developed the modern Māori pass system, which is specifically designed to counter British artillery. So, you know, in a number of these conflicts, a typical sort of scenario is that the British bombard a pa for days. They expect everybody inside to be dead. They storm the pa and they discover that that's not the case at all. That happens at Ohiawai in 1845, and it happens nearly 20 years later at Gate Pa in 1864. The British are constantly surprised by Māori military engineering genius, and in fact, often they suspect that there must be Pākehā behind this, because they assume Māori are not clever enough to work out these tactics themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there a definitive winner of these wars?
Well, that's much debated. It kind of depends on which conflict you're talking about, because you can go through that one by one. Like the Northern War is especially contested. I would say that there was no clear winner of that conflict. In terms of the main sequence of the wars in the 1860s, I think the Crown forces did enough to impose their version of the treaty relationship. But having said that, some Māori have said that they read my Great War for New Zealand book really as a survival narrative, in the sense that Governor Grey didn't go to war in 1863 to teach the kingitanga or Waikato Māori a lesson. He went to war to destroy the kingitanga, and it's still here today, and so are Tainui. So in that sense, you know, just considering what they're up against, just surviving is quite an achievement, really. Having said that, you know, when the Crown's ability to impose its understanding of what the relationship will be in future has almost immediate drastic consequences. One is its ability to impose land confiscation. Another is its ability to impose things like, so the Waikato War ends in 1864. Within 12 months of that, you get the Native Land Court established, which has been described by Sir Hugh Kāwhiru as an engine of destruction for Māori society. 2 years after that, in 1867, you get the Native School System established, which is an agent for assimilation. So, you know, one of those strips Māori of their land, the other of their language, and we still live with the consequences of that today. Neither of those institutions would have been possible without victory in the New Zealand Wars on the Crown's part.
Now, it's interesting that you're talking about the consequences. What is the wider, I guess, legacy of these wars? Are we still seeing the effects of these wars today?
I think so. I think you could see it strongly, for example, in socioeconomic statistics, arguably in health, and even in terms of the fact that 50% of our prison population is Māori. And, you know, the way Pākehā kind of think about this is like stuff that happened way back then, but the way Māori think about it is it's part of the present. This is a history that we continue to live today, and the New Zealand Wars, that, you know, they continue to resonate now in many ways, I think.
There seems to have been a renewed interest in the wars in recent years, particularly, I guess, amongst Pākehā. Why do you think it took so long for the wars to come back into prominence?
Well, there's a kind of interesting history to the way that Pākehā have engaged with these conflicts, because for a long time there was this kind of myth-making around the wars, and they were seen as these chivalrous and noble, almost romantic conflicts where Māori and Pākehā had fought valiantly and bravely against one another and then settled down to become the best of friends. So I've argued that really the New Zealand Wars is the origin of this kind of myth of New Zealanders having the best race relations in the world. And, you know, for example, in 1914, the 50th anniversary of Ōrākau, the biggest battle of the Waikato War, is called a celebration. But it's only Pākehā there, really. There are some Māori, but it's Pākehā celebrating these wars because they have this kind of mythical understanding of them. And that continues really through until at least the 1960s. But by about the 1970s, you can't really get away with celebrating these wars anymore. So Pākehā just stopped talking about them. There's no kind of acceptable narrative to Pākehā about these wars. So it becomes sort of don't mention the New Zealand Wars. And there's a backlash when people do in critical ways. And I think you're right. That's only really started to shift in the last, maybe even the last 5 years. I think part of that is obviously the remarkable efforts of the students at Otorohanga College and their petition in 2015. But also I think I'm trying to talk about these wars in a way that is not finger-pointing, but saying this is part of our history. These are terrible events, but we need to be mature enough as a nation to take ownership of this history, warts and all. This is part of the process of maturing as a nation, is not just cherry picking the bits of your history that you'd prefer to remember, but actually owning up to all of it and having that dialogue, having that understanding around the history. Because, you know, for most of the past 100 years, it's been left to Māori to remember this history in anything approaching a truthful way.
Now, you've been known to say that these wars were the making of New Zealand, a defining moment of New Zealand becoming a nation. Why do you think this?
Because the wars were instrumental in terms of the Crown having the ability to impose its vision on what the treaty was. And so that really means that in the 1860s, Pākehā have the ability to impose their will on Māori communities. The treaty is thrown out the window for the next century or more. There's kind of this myth-making around these conflicts. And there are all sorts of other things that happen as a result of these wars. If you think of, you know, in the Waikato, for example, 1.2 million acres of land is confiscated and ultimately occupied by settlers. And that land ultimately proves to be incredibly valuable. If you would imagine if Fonterra today was owned by Māori. I mean, we're sort of talking about things like that. And in the case of Tainui, when they signed their treaty settlement in 1995, I think it was, that the lands that were confiscated from them were valued at $12 billion. That's the unimproved value. And the treaty settlement was $170 million, which is 1.4% of that. So in effect, anyway, when they signed treaty settlements, signed away 98% of everything that they lost. People don't realise that. People who haven't been exposed to the history think that this is a bunch of tribal elites getting rich at the expense of everybody else. And that couldn't be further from the truth. But we just don't have that historical literacy as a nation to understand that. And I think that's why potentially learning this history in schools is going to be transformative in the future, because people will grow up with that awareness of that history and that context.
Yes, it's interesting you mentioned the teaching of it in the schools. Do you think our historical literacy moving forward will improve as that becomes more entrenched in the curriculums?
Yeah, I hope so. And I think, I mean, what I could potentially see happening is school students educating their parents and grandparents who didn't have the opportunity to learn about this during their own school years. And I think, you know, the thing around this is that young people have themselves been calling for this for years, and it's really just been the adults who have been saying no. You know, the Otorohanga College students, they called for this history to be taught in all schools, and the Ministry of Education turned up at the Select Committee at Parliament and said, no, not possible. So they opposed that petition. And now they've been called upon to implement this new curriculum. So it's, you know, my experience in visiting dozens of schools in the last few years is that young people really want to engage with this history, and they understand the importance of it in a way that's far more mature than many adults have approached it in the past. So I think, to me, that's a real positive.
Now, what do you make of the debate around memorials of colonial figures in these wars and how some people want these memorials taken down?
The monuments and memorials reflect the priorities and values of those who erected them. And a lot of the ones from the New Zealand Wars are erected in the early 20th century. And if you look at them, often they are monuments to imperialism and colonialism, really. And some of them, you can see in them this kind of myth-making around Māori and Pākehā as the best of friends. I think the monument on Simon Street has a plaque on it with Māori and Pākehā shaking hands or honging. I can't remember, but it's kind of embracing this notion that Māori and Pākehā lived happily ever after. And so I think it's healthy to have discussions around how this history is remembered in monuments and memorials, in place names and street names. And I don't think that there's necessarily a one-size-fits-all solution to this, such as get rid of them all or keep them all. I think it's more of a case-by-case basis, and Mana Whenua need to be at the forefront of those conversations. And even with, you know, with the monuments, it, you know, besides leaving them as they are or getting rid of them, there are a range of other alternatives. And one is to contextualize them through providing information panels that provide the missing context, really, about what these wars were. Another option is to add additional monuments from today's perspective, honouring those who were forgotten in these earlier ones, which predominantly celebrate Pākehā and men, of course.
Now, just one final question about commemoration. Why do you think it's important now in the 21st century that we remember these wars?
I think it's important because it speaks to our willingness to have that dialogue that's grounded in a genuine understanding of this history. And that is, I think, a key to genuine reconciliation and healing, which is founded on mutual understanding. And for too long, Māori have remembered this history and Pākehā have either ignored it or misremembered it. And I think it's time for the rest of us to step up and engage with this history properly so that we can, as a nation, you know, have that awareness of the lands that we live upon and the stories that those lands that are embedded in those lands. That's part of who we are today. And it's also, I think, having that historical grounding gives you a sense of where you've come from and therefore makes it easier to work out where you might be going in the future, what you aspire to become.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Vincent.
You're welcome.